Welcome to the Phil Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and it is 1:36 p.m. the Pacific Summer Time. Today is August 21st, and it's Friday, so it's the big picture long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. Well, I thought it would be appropriate to kick off with the size of the central bank balance sheets globally. It's at $27 trillion, and it's still a lot rising, so that means that we still have a lot of liquidity that's in the market. And it's also worth considering that the size of the global central bank balance sheet totals has gone from 5 to $27 trillion since 2006. So anyone who's looking for some rationale for why we've had such a massive increase in asset prices, everything from stocks to bonds to fixed assets like property in that time, well, they don't have far to look. Now, there is the additional point, though, when we zoom in and look at just simply the last 6 months. We've had a massive increase in a very short period of time. It's gone up $6 trillion. And it's worth considering that the pace of the advance has, in fact, been moderating. So it's now, if it's been moderating, there has to be a reason for that. Well, the two primary factors that drive the expansion of this chart are the willingness of central banks to add assets to their balance sheets, but then also the weakness of the dollar. It's a rebased chart, so everything is shown in US dollars. The weaker the US dollar is, the greater the weighting that overseas central bank assets have. So when we look at the willingness of the ECB to increase the size of its balance sheet, and it has been going up in a straight line so far. Well, part of the reason that the total assets is still rising is because the ECB is increasing the size of its balance sheet, although less so in the last 6 weeks, and also because the euro has been strengthening. So they've added in a substantial quantity of money, and the euro has gone up at the same time. Well, the euro is pausing in the region of 120. It was off its lows in here today. It's holding the lower side of this range that's been forming now for the last month. And it's, I think, quite likely that we can get some additional ranging. But so far, the reaction is relatively similar size to the one that we saw in June and July. There is still a wide overextension relative to the trend mean, so it's not beyond the bounds of possibility that we may see a deeper process of consolidation. But the most important thing is that it has broken the downtrend, and a really meaningful pullback would be required to question that we're not now in a new demand dominated environment. And these are some of the more important points: that the dollar itself is a major source of liquidity, and if the dollar is likely to deteriorate further, then it's also lending a great deal of assistance to anyone who's taken out debt in US dollars. And there are a substantial number of those in the emerging markets. So we're still not out of the coronavirus. This is something that is inhibiting the ability of emerging markets to really move into a position of outperformance right now. When we think about the aftermath of 2009, I'm simply take the Indonesian market as an example. There was obviously a very big sell-off, but then it started to outperform within the space of, it had already bottomed in 2008. It had put in a higher reaction low by the time the wider Wall Street indices had bottomed in 2009, and it was pushing new highs by the middle of 2010, only about a year after one of the biggest pullbacks in history. And then it really did keep going until about 2013. After that, the currency, the dollar started to recover, and it sapped some of the interest in these emerging markets, high growth markets, though they may be. So what's inhibiting these markets from rebounding in a more impressive manner right now is this: the continued uncertainty about the ability of emerging market economies to deal with the coronavirus. Some have been more successful than others, and then you also have countries that have got larger young populations, and then they have tended to do better. It is among the the countries that have got older populations, and particularly with a tradition of living in multi-generational households, have been particularly hard hit by the coronavirus. And this is still a big uncertainty. It's something that is likely to be a factor for at least another 6 months, because we just don't know how long it's going to take for recoveries to really start to take hold. The one thing we do know, however, is that when we look at commodity prices, the fact that we have this enormous amount of liquidity, then it has helped commodity prices to rebound. And copper in particular has broken its downtrend. Now, it was in negative territory over the last 2 days. It has not been able to hold the move above the 300 cent mark, and it was down again in here today. So now the question is, are we going to see a pullback towards the 280 level, or is it going to rebound next week? And is all of this potentially also because the dollar is oversold and we may be about to get some pause and consolidation in terms of that as well? But the bigger picture here is that because of this massive uncertainty, because there are so many people that are unemployed and governments that are dealing with popular protests left and right, then they are likely to do whatever is necessary to try and get people back to work. And one of the things that they will do is to create more infrastructure. So then you also have to think about some of the challenges that emerging markets in particular have. China has had these massive floods, and they still have these massive floods. Well, at the very minimum, that's going to require a lot of rebuilding. And that's just the best case scenario. Then, of course, we have the fact because of the coronavirus, there are a lot of people are now moving around and looking for better living conditions. People are now less tolerant of very dense living patterns in cities. Now, that may not last. People will start to miss the buzz of the city after a while. But it is certainly creating a lot of demand for lumber in a very short period of time, and the price has more than doubled in the course of just the last 7 or 8 weeks. So it was almost limit up in here today. It is worth, I think, reminding ourselves that the limits have been, or in fact, it was limit up today. The limits were 15, they're now 30. So they've doubled the limits on lumber. And when you get these kinds of accelerations like we're getting right now, well, eventually they will start to increase margins, and that will represent an end to this incredible bull market. But it is still moving higher, and there is obviously an acute shortage of lumber for home building. Not only do we have demand for new houses, and particularly houses in suburbia, but people want bigger houses. So that's also a concession to the fact that people are working from home, that children are schooling from home, that everybody is demanding their own individual space, and that requires bigger houses. Well, that is creating a lot of demand for building of new homes, and also people moving further out of the city and looking at solutions that include moving to the suburbs. So we're getting a lot of new activity. But of course, home building is extremely resource intense, and it's a massive employer. So then this is also an additional factor that should help to stimulate economic growth, because as soon as you start building new homes, well, then you need stuff to put inside those new homes. So you need new kitchens, new hardware, new white goods, new furniture, and then new entertainment equipment. So this kind of activity is something that has got a reasonably long tail. Then when we look at some of the producers, or I guess the retailers of home goods and building materials, well, Home Depot has continued to extend its advance, but it is overbought in the short term, so it's due consolidation. Lowe's had broken out even faster, but and it's at also at new highs. And continuing to extend those advances. And it has, again, another share that has more than doubled since the lows in March. So when we start to think about economic growth, well, this year will represent a year of synchronized global economic contraction. We've seen economies compress almost universally. And I saw an interesting graphic in here this week, and it gives us an idea of just how much GDP has been shaved off of global economies. The Italian economy is now back to the same size of GDP that it was in the third quarter of 1993. So they've knocked 27 years off of growth, because Europe has been contracting since 2007 in many respects. Greece and Portugal, in fact, have not pulled back by as much as Italy has. Then when we think about the UK, it's back to where it was in 2004. For the USA, it's back to where it was in the fourth quarter of 2014. So it has basically erased the growth of the last 6 years. South Korea is back to where it was at the end of 2017. So we've had a very significant reset in terms of GDP growth. This has been a phenomenal year of economic contraction. Now, it's worth considering that if everything went down together this year, and it is interesting that at the end of last year, every single asset class returned a positive return. This year, every single economy will have recorded a negative return. Then in 2021, it's quite likely that we're going to have a period of synchronized global economic expansion, because we've just printed $6 trillion. And the quantity of money that has been printed is one thing, but monetary policy acts with a lagged effect. So the stock market has priced in that effect very quickly. The economy, though, will take about 6 months to do so. So that suggests that we're going to start to see economic statistics improve from about September onwards. Now, when we start to think about the effect that all this home building, the potential for infrastructure development, are going to have on commodity prices, well, copper has broken its downtrend. Lumber has been accelerating higher. Then we have the, I guess, what might be described as the new economy metals like nickel, which is now back above its trend mean as well. Zinc prices have also been doing better from here, and have also been steadier over the course of the last while. Now, zinc has just about broken its downtrend, but it does have room in which to consolidate, and I think it's likely that we will have consolidation. Then we have the fact that oil prices contracted in here today, but were well off the lows. So the big question then, when we look at oil prices, is are they going to collapse, go sideways, or rebound further? These are the big questions. Because if oil prices were to contract meaningfully from here, well, then that would certainly stoke deflationary fears. If we get additional ranging around this level, well, I think that would be more of a response to the fact that some supply is coming out of the market, but perhaps not enough. If we see prices moving higher from here, it would tell us that a lot of supply has already come out of the market, and that it takes time for imbalances to feed through. But we are at an area of potential resistance in the region of the trend mean and around the psychological $40 area. So it's a natural area where we could expect some pause, and we are getting that pause. But the reality is that despite the fact that everyone is talking about batteries and the growth of the electric car market, then it's still not enough to really impact the global oil market in a big way. What it is in fact doing is really pressuring the growth, and that is cutting into the status quo for oil. When we think about the industrial resources, then there is an argument that we haven't had a lot of infrastructure development or new mines built in the last few years, so they have potential to rally further. The reason oil prices have not yet been able to break their downtrend is simple enough. There has been extraordinary investment in additional new production infrastructure, particularly in the USA, over the course of the last decade. And some of that is now uneconomic, and it will be removed from the market. It's not really until it's been removed from the market that we can see a recovery come through. Then it's unlikely we're going to see oil prices move higher than $80, for the simple reason that unconventional oil and gas is sensitive to prices, and that if you stop drilling, you can automatically reduce supply. So it's sensitive to the oil price, and that allows producers to customize production to price levels. And obviously there's a lag, it's probably a 2-month lag, and that's also confirmed by the rebound that we've had over the course of the last few months. It took about 2 months for the oil price to in fact bottom, and then it started to rebound. So we may get some additional consolidation here, but I think it is more likely than not that over the course of the next year or two, we're going to see prices go back up towards the $80 area. But oil stocks pulled back rather sharply in here this week and are now back in the region of the lower side of this range that's been forming for the last 4 months. When I was going to put up the dividend, companies like Exxon have never cut their dividend. And then we think about the fact that it's yielding 8.5%. So Prius, because of the accelerator problem that we had, or that they had in 2010. Now the problem is that for people who are not accustomed to risk, and for investors that have been content to buy bonds for a long time because all they wanted was to lock in a return, they are under extraordinary pressure in here right now, because government bond yields the world over have collapsed, and 10-year yields at 63 basis points is really quite an extraordinarily low level. And what I find interesting is that we had a pop on the upside in the second week of the month, right around the time when the US Treasury tried to extend the maturity of new debt. Now, it's a no-brainer for any government to sell long-term debt when they can pay almost nothing back on it. Then they have the opportunity to inflate the debt over a long period of time, and they essentially never pay the money back. Well, obviously investors need to be taking the opposite idea, that if the currency is going to be devalued, well, then we need to start thinking about how to protect ourselves. The reality is that when we have these extraordinarily low interest rates, it basically forces people that are unaccustomed and ill-prepared into highly risky ventures. And when we think about government bonds and the way that they've been considered a benchmark asset and a risk-free rate, well, anything outside of that sector is going to be considered more risky. But then we have the additional point that pension funds, life insurance companies, they need to match their assets to their liabilities. And that's extraordinarily difficult in a low interest rate environment. So they are moving increasingly towards private equity, or more correctly, alternative assets. So they're looking at anything that can provide a yield. It doesn't necessarily mean that they can provide the yield today, as long as there is the promise of a yield in future, because then they'll discount those cash flows to today, and that will allow them to create a valuation. Well, the kinds of companies that have been able to make that argument have rallied spectacularly. So Sunrun is a perfect example of that kind of business model where they don't make a profit and they don't have a PE, and it's a $6 billion company. When we think about the size of the debt that they have taken on, well, their debt is at about $2.2 trillion. You can also see that their free cash flow rate has in fact been declining over time. So they're borrowing more money because of the promise of future cash flows. So basically what they do is they go along to the homeowner and they say, we'll put the solar panels on your roof for free. That will reduce your overhead in terms of your utility bill, but we will be charging you a utility-like bill. And the general payback on the solar cells is about 5 years. After that, it's all profit. And that rationale works perfectly in a low interest rate environment because they can borrow money for next to nothing. Then they lock in long-term cash flows because in order to get out of the agreement, the homeowner would have to buy the solar cells, or they would have to pay to have them removed. And that is not an attractive prospect for many people. Well, this is exactly the kind of business model that people, that pension funds will pour money into, because the rationale is simple. The more solar panels that they can put on roofs, the more cash flows that they can lock in, and then they get the return on investment on a longer term basis. They don't get the return right away because they're still investing in the build out and the capture of market share, but you'll get your profit eventually. Now, it's a highly risky enterprise because in the event that interest rates rise, then it will instantly go bankrupt. But there's little prospect of interest rates rising in the near term. So it's exactly the kind of high risk proposition that pension funds and life insurance companies are pouring money into. Now, these are companies and pools of capital that are unaccustomed to taking these kinds of risks. This is Tesla in a microcosm. Now, the share pushed directly through 2000 in here today. It was up another $48. Tesla is what is effectively a risk arbitrage or a regulatory arbitrage company. They have been able to engineer a situation where they are leeching capital out of their competitors. So because of the fact that they're producing electric vehicles, they're getting carbon credits. The more electric vehicles they produce, the more batteries they produce, the greater the revenue they receive from those carbon credits. Without the benefit of the carbon credits, there isn't a prayer they'd be able to turn a profit. So now they have the additional point that the more batteries they produce, the greater the revenue potential they have from carbon credits. And this is a condition that will last for as long as it takes the other automotive companies to ditch internal combustion engines and join them in producing batteries. Then Tesla's ability to sell carbon credits will deteriorate, or they will need to find other customers to buy those carbon credits. Now, that could potentially be, for example, coal-fired power stations, except that they are now also disappearing, and not least because of the prolonged bear market in natural gas. Now, natural gas prices are beginning to rally, and they were up again in here today. But The important point, of course, is that natural gas is extraordinarily low on a secular basis. It's one of the few commodities that got all the way back down to the lows that prevailed before the big commodity bull market. Low prices for a vital commodity like natural gas create demand, and people are increasingly looking to the natural gas market as the provider of an essential ingredient for various different chemical processes, and one of those is to create hydrogen. Hydrogen gels well with the evolution of battery technology. Now, right now we have got 8-to-1-to-1 chemistries for batteries, and that is nickel to manganese to cobalt. Well, the demand for nickel is certainly being met. Nickel prices are rising, but they're not rising in a straight line. One of the challenges with batteries that we have today is that their range is in the region of about 300 miles for a Tesla, for example. That also means that you can probably go 3 or 4 days without charging it, and it costs about $700 to install a charger at home. Of course, that is assuming that you have a home. Now, of course, a lot of the homes that are being built right now will have electric vehicle chargers inside them. Now, the question then is, what about range? What about for vehicles that need to drive further than that and do not have the luxury of remaining idle for 12 hours to fully charge the battery? So we're talking about haulage vehicles, and then, more importantly, planes and boats. IMO 2020 went into effect in January, and one of the major factors that was, I think, adopted by many of the shipbuilders. I'm sorry, I'm not doing this particularly effectively. When, oh, hold on, I'm just really, I don't know why that's not working. So the Baltic Dry Index was just beginning to pop on the upside last year. And then what we saw was that it collapsed again immediately ahead of the coronavirus crisis. Then we've seen it rebound again from the middle of this year, but it's still below 2000. Now, 2000 was a really important point of resistance in the period before the big commodity boom. And every time the price got up towards 2000, it failed. Well, now when we think about the fact that we're going to have a lot of home building, we're going to have a lot of infrastructure building, then there is also the additional point that China has had a massive problem with the swine flu. Then there was the infestation of locusts. Then you have the there were hailstorms that knocked out apples and pears last year. The incarceration of millions of people in Xinjiang has knocked out some of the agricultural production from that region, and it is a highly prolific region for fruits in particular, in really a very similar fashion to the way the Central Valley is in California. And then you have the floods. So there is the real potential that there is going to be increasing demand for movement of foodstuffs next year, industrial resources. We've already seen a significant move in iron ore, but then also industrial resources as well. And a large number of ships were junked last year, not least because the cost of the scrubbers to clean out the exhausts of the ships often exceeded the value of the ship. So there is the potential now that we're looking at a supply inelasticity meets rising demand environment. And rising shipping costs will contribute to higher prices for everything. If oil prices consolidate in the region of $40 and push higher from here, that will also contribute to higher prices, and not least on a year-over-year comparison if we're looking into next year. There's the real potential that we could have an inflationary outcome, where if we're looking now at a period of global economic contraction next year, it could quite easily be synchronized global economic expansion. But we have $6 trillion that is sitting in the global economy. The only way to avoid that becoming an inflationary problem is to take some of it out if the velocity of money increases. But we also have, because of the incredible advances that we've had, Apple this week, it did pause around the $2 trillion mark, and then today it added on an extra $100 billion. So it's now right in the region of $500. And really, this has been an incredibly impressive advance, up in excess of 100% since March, for by far the largest company in the world. The size of the company now exceeds the value of some of the economies in the G7. Now, there is no doubt that the iPhone is a phenomenal product and that they have a backlog of orders. But the reality is that Apple has got some substantial challenges in front of it. And the first is that it stands out as being a target for issues or for, I guess, reciprocal measures that China could levy against the USA for the trade war. Apple has been uniquely successful in playing both sides and giving both sides exactly what they want. And that has allowed it to prosper despite the trade war that's been evolving between the USA and China. It really does begin to ask the question, how long can this last? But this is still a market that is going higher. The pace of the advance has certainly accelerated over the beginning of August. The first clear downward dynamic is likely to mark a peak of at least near-term and really, I think, quite possibly medium-term significance. Of course, it's been a lightning rod for anyone who wants to express a bullish perspective. But we can also think about the fact that the price is now accelerating, and it's very clearly accelerating. It might yet go further, and there's no evidence that it won't yet go further. And we also have the fact that the mega cap stocks, and particularly the FANG index, are now really firing on all cylinders. And the pace of the advance is picking up. In fact, again, if we look at this on a log scale chart, even when you adjust for the percentage gains, the pace of the advance is accelerating. Now, acceleration is a trend-ending signal, but it's of undetermined duration. Now, the reality is that we are seeing the biggest companies in the world accelerate higher. They have almost universally demonstrated that they are the primary beneficiaries of extraordinary monetary policy. If we think back at the most benign factor for markets over the course of the last 12 years, it has been the willingness of central banks to print extraordinary amounts of money. And the size of national deficits has increased substantially. There is the clear potential that we are moving into a period of debt monetization. And stocks generally do well in the early part of a new inflationary cycle. There is the real potential that what we are looking at is a new inflationary boom. Well, we may eventually then see that it turns into an inflationary bust. But at the beginning of a new inflationary period, you have ample liquidity. then that begins to create more demand, and you get more infrastructure development, more home building, more demand for goods and services. Then you get people asking for more wages. Now, the one thing that I find particularly interesting is that many economists today are assuming that because you have millions of people that are unemployed, wages are going to drop. But this is not a normal recession. The kind of unemployment benefits in the USA that were provided to people, the kind of assistance programs, for example, in the UK, where self-employed people were afforded unemployment insurance, and there were substantial additional measures provided to unemployed people. It means that they have not experienced the same kind of drawdown in terms of earnings. Many people that are unemployed in the USA and were earning more from being unemployed than they were from being employed, they feel like they earned that money. Well, that's hard to square when you're unemployed and not working at all, and you're suddenly making more money than you were from working. Well, what's it going to take to not just encourage those people back to work, but to placate them? Because once you are paid additional funds for doing nothing, then people will very quickly begin to feel entitled to that money. Now, we have had incredible social disruptions as a result of the lockdowns and the coronavirus, but this is not happening in isolation. This has been going on now for most of the last 5 or 6 years. This breaking of the status quo, the hollowing out of the middle class, which has been going on for 20 years, has led to these populist revolutions in everywhere from India to Brazil, from Italy to the USA to the UK, and they are all a response to the hollowing out of the middle classes. Now, when you give people better unemployment benefits as a result of what is effectively a natural disaster, well, it's going to be very hard for them to go back to earning less from doing more. That does suggest that we're going to have greater wage demand growth, that people are going to demand to be paid more. And again, that is inflationary, and most particularly if we don't get significant productivity growth as part of it. Well, the evolution of cloud computing has the potential to deliver productivity growth, but how much productivity growth can it deliver that it hasn't delivered already? I think part of the reason why we're getting this phenomenal move in asset prices is simple enough that we are now in the mania stage of the bull market, and the mania stage is characterized by contradiction. The clearest contradiction that we have today is that all central banks have to do is to promise to do something, and then they don't have to. So the Federal Reserve said that they were going to buy $80 billion worth of treasuries and $40 billion worth of mortgages a month. And as soon as they made that commitment back in May, the size of the balance sheet stopped expanding. So, in fact, they are not buying $80 billion of treasuries or $40 billion of mortgages right now, but they said they would. Then we can also think about the fact that they have said that they're not introducing a standing repo facility. But everybody knows that if there is a problem of liquidity in the repo market, they will definitely step in. They have said that they do not believe that yield curve control is worthwhile and that they're not doing it, but the bond, or excuse me, the bond market is behaving as if they are doing it. So there is all of these examples in the bond markets where the and I guess another one that was very clear is that they said they would buy corporate bonds, and they haven't had to. The market did it for them. So everybody assumes, and it is now absolutely clear to everyone in the market, that it doesn't matter how bad the news is, the Fed will ride to the rescue. It doesn't matter how large the quantity of money that needs to be printed is. If there is a liquidity problem, the Fed will come to the rescue. And that is obviously robbing savers of money, but it's manna from heaven for speculators. And speculators have a clear incentive to take the biggest risks possible, because then they have the potential to be bailed out. And if the performance of companies like United or any one of the other airlines teaches us anything, it's that you can pay all of your profits out in dividends, you can maintain no buffer at all, but because you're a systemically important business, you'll get bailed out. Now, it does not mean that these companies are going to become clear investment opportunities, but they won't go bust either. That's the same rationale that Boeing used. Well, Boeing has got some still very large problems, but at the same time, it's not going to be allowed to go bust. Obviously, these are not the shares that are leading on the upside. They have got the greatest potential to go sideways for a prolonged period of time. The clear beneficiaries are the companies that can generate growth off of the massive amount of money that is sitting on in the global economy and sloshing around. So that is clearly favoring the technology companies. The growth potential from the commodity producers is quite clear because of the demand for the creation of new assets. Then there is also the potential for renewables to represent a real clear new bull market environment. And it's exactly for that reason that Sunrun has been doing well. They represent the promise of potential cash flows in the future. Well, this again, it's a promise of future potential. It's almost exactly the same thing that we're getting from the bond market, the equity market, where Apple is trading on a PE today. I think it was 35 yesterday. It's probably higher in here today. I think it's at 38 and a half in here today, so it's gone up another couple of points. Well, that's pricing in a lot of future potential. It's pulling forward sales from the future. And this is also exactly what we anticipate in the mania phase of a bull market, because this is earnings agnostic investing. The success of ETFs and the fact that ETFs are now by far the largest pool of liquidity, they're closet momentum strategies because they are market cap weighted. That gives the benefit of the doubt to the largest companies, and large companies then go on to occupy bigger portions of the index. That means that even more money flowing into the index will go into these shares. And the kinds of moves that we're seeing, where a share like Apple can rise 5% in a day, well, that's not because their growth is suddenly improving one day to the next, but it is because interest rates are so very low. So it is at creating a promise kind of environment. So there are lots of promises being made. There is the potential that Tesla will be able to sell more cars in future, or that they'll be able to build more batteries and get even more carbon credits. Obviously, there is a logical terminal point to this kind of business model, but we haven't reached it yet. It's exactly the same with the renewable energy, and then when we think about the evolution of hydrogen, then it's also predicated on the potential for promises in future. Now, it all depends then on how long does it take interest rates to in fact rise, because the longer we have extraordinarily low interest rates, the more time that highly capital-intensive companies have to reach that point where they can sustainably make a profit. Potentially, Tesla is getting there. Potentially, SpaceX with reusable rockets and Blue Origin have already achieved that goal. Are we quite there yet with other technologies? The one thing, though, that we do know is that the pace of technological innovation is accelerating at an exponential pace. What's, I think, more important is that some of those technologies are improving even faster. If we think about Moore's Law, that was adopted in response to the doubling of the number of transistors on a chip every 18 months. Well, the doubling of efficiency in genetic sequencing has gone much faster than that. The improvements that we're seeing in quantum computing continue to increase on practically a monthly basis. IBM announced yesterday that they hit a new record in terms of the efficiency of a quantum computer. Google have been saying that the pace of their advances are happening at an exponential pace, so double the exponential. So that is the kind of thing that is going to have a meaningful effect on the markets in future. The one thing about artificial intelligence is that you really only have to train a computer system once, whereas you have to teach every new human from scratch. Well, that iterative process for computers is something that is going to continue to lead to innovation. Now, one of the big promises that has not been solved are solid-state batteries. The deadline for delivering solid-state batteries has been pushed back. Now, the next one is 2023. I remember in 2018 it was 2020. So this deadline keeps getting pushed back. When these are eventually delivered, well, then that is going to be a game changer for batteries. It will double the range and halve the charging time, but we don't have them yet. That suggests that we're still in the growth phase for the market, but technological innovation is going to continue to increase. But against that, we have interest rates. And the potential is that inflation becomes an issue next year, that the synchronized global economic expansion and wage demand growth will have an inflationary impact. And because of debt monetization, then we have the fact that asset prices are rising, and that is helping gold. So gold prices have been consolidating. I think one of the most important things to bear in mind with gold is that it goes up in an incredibly abrupt manner, and then we get consolidations. And that has been the hallmark of the price and the action that we've had for at least the last 20 years, that it tends to range, then when it breaks out, it goes up faster and further and beyond the expectations of most people in the market for longer than anyone anticipates. And then when everyone is falling over themselves to buy, we get a pullback. Well, so far, this reaction has been quite shallow, only approximately 10%, and roughly the same size as the pullback we had in March. It's unwinding the overextension relative to the trend mean, and we could see this range forming for another few months. Silver prices have begun to outperform gold, and this has been a really very impressive breakout from what was effectively a decade-long base. The price was also in negative territory, but off the lows in here today, and it's been pretty much going nowhere now for approximately 10 sessions. But it's still consolidating. It's the first consolidation following the breakout. Now, it could come back towards 20. I really don't think we're going to see it trade below 20 on a sustained basis. And it is gradually unwinding the overextension relative to the trend mean. Now, if we look at the gold-silver ratio, then we can, I think, draw some important conclusions. The first is that silver does tend to underperform in the first 2 years of a new bull market. When we can think about the fact that the gold price started to trend higher against silver even from 1995. It wasn't really until 2003 that gold started to underperform silver. Then it outperformed again in the credit crisis, and then silver really outperformed all the way through until the peak in 2011. And then it underperformed for the last 9 years and gold reached a new high relative to silver. Now, the breakout has broken that trend. Now, it would be, I think, too much to hope for. Even when we think about the really considerable outperformance of silver in these periods, it didn't happen in a straight line. So we've had a very clear move over the course of the last few months. Now, if we just zoom in and look at the last year, well, certainly silver's outperformance relative to gold has paused in August. There is a very considerable move that's already happened. So it's not beyond the bounds of possibility that we do get some additional consolidation and that silver will underperform gold for a little while, but that when the bull market starts moving again, that silver will begin to outperform once more. Well, the beginning of the outperformance of silver relative to gold is the beginning of the second section of, or the second psychological perception stage of the bull market. Platinum has not yet broken out. It's still consolidating between the trend mean and $1,000, and that represents the upper side of the base that's been forming now for the last 4 years. So investors are still in need of convincing that it's not just a gold and silver story. People are beginning to look at gold miners. This is exactly the point in the cycle when they should do well. And they have done spectacularly well over the course of the last 6 months. But they are equally due some consolidation. We've had a phenomenal bull run, so there is ample scope for consolidation. But then it's also worth considering that the cost of producing gold has risen substantially in the last 15 years. And it's now averaging about $700 an ounce. Well, $700 an ounce when the price of gold is at $1,900 is a very substantial margin. Now, gold miners are not investing that money right now. Companies like Newmont are paying out their dividend as it's tied to the gold price. So no company in the S&P raised its dividend by more than Newmont in the second quarter. It's a very attractive time for investors because they can get in an attractive, really world-beating yield from gold mines that are producing an asset of limited supply that is in high demand. ETF holdings of gold continue to increase. So this has been one of the clearest flows of money into the gold market, into ETF holdings, and that's physical gold. There is now a COMEX contract for physical delivery. So there will be increasingly large quantities of gold taken into are taken off the market through the delivery of contracts. Now, that's an additional, very important factor, that if this physical contract gains in popularity, well, then we're going to see increasingly large quantities of physical gold taken off the market, and that will additionally lend impetus to more price appreciation over the medium term. But the long and the short of it is very simple, that we've had this panicky environment where governments the world over have massively increased their debts. They are not in a position to pay back those debts. And populations have absolutely no patience for the kind of fiscal consolidation and cuts to living standards that would be required to even begin to pay them back. On top of that, liabilities that governments have in terms of social services are considerably beyond their ability to fund. Well, that pretty much ensures that we're going to have debt monetization. And that is also inflationary. These are the kinds of factors that contribute to inflation. It doesn't all happen at once. A bull market like this unfolds over years. There will be ebb and flow. There will be times when the price does phenomenally well, and there will also be times when it pulls back sharply. And those are almost universally buying opportunities in a bull market. And there is absolutely no doubt that we are now in a bull market in gold. The one important point is that gold prices have only just broken out, whereas the equity market has been rallying for 12 years already, and bonds have been rallying for 40 years. So we're at a point for bonds where they do represent acute risk. The sensitivity of the price to low interest rates is extremely acute. The compression of yields is leading to and forcing a great deal of risky activity. Inflation is by far the greatest threat to that condition. As long as we do not get inflation, then we can continue to see a bubble inflate. It's when inflationary pressures rise. And the 2% level on the 30-year is, an important level to monitor. We still have a downtrend in terms of the 30-year yield, and it contracted again in here today to hold the sequence of lower rally highs. We may not see a climactic event in terms of a blowout, in terms of the bubbly activity in stocks, until all bonds move into negative territory. We're not quite there yet. U.S. Long bonds are not negative. Even when we think about something shorter term, like the 2-year, it has not moved negative. We're still at 14 basis points. There is the potential that yields will be taken negative, that governments will be encouraged to go for negative yields and negative interest rates. That's going to set off a panicky environment where longer-term investors have no alternative at all to gross speculation in the markets. Well, that is exactly the conditions that the stock market is pricing in now. It's exactly the condition that is helping gold prices to do better. But when we look at the horizon, then we know where the answer lies, that inflationary pressures are likely to rise eventually. And when they do, it is going to mean a rather disastrous outcome for the most leveraged investors. And with that, I'll leave you for the weekend and wish all the best to all of you.